The disturbing secrets of the Harrow family has now been revealed in its entirety. A lineage of violence that could have and should have been stopped before the cycle of devastation reached at this point here today. It's not just about baby Emmanuel. It's the collapse of the justice system that allowed this abuser, repeated abuser, to walk free, to have a life. It's a fake kidnapping story and the start of a nobody murder prosecution case for now. Although the DA on this case says he's got a good idea where the child's body is, it is just a matter of time and resources. Right now, Jake and Rebecca Harrow are charged with murder and filing a false police report in the death of their 7-month-old son. And Emmanuel's body has yet to be discovered after an extensive search in a fielded wooded area. Now, I've got new information, an exclusive coroner confirmation related to the couple's past, and a fresh DA filing that hints at how prosecutors plan to build this case, reaching into the family's past that explains the present. Thank you for spending time with me. I'm Melissa. Let's get into this very complex, fluid case.
They want justice. They want answers.
It stands out to you about his personality.
What's the family want most of all?
Closure.
But you were just the last person to see her.
Get
there's
out of my
an
yard
arrest warrant.
In Lee.
You have a lot of weighty accusations.
The search continues for 7-month-old Emmanuel. I can't even imagine what his last moments of his short life was like, helpless in the hands of evil. This child was abused repeatedly day after day, month after month, abused until finally his little body gave in. It was too much to bear. And his 7-month-old heart, body, and lungs just gave in to repeated inflicted injuries by the hands of his own parents, his evil parents. One, a known child abuser. When this kidnapping, the call came in to Riverside Sheriff's, they were on the hunt for a man who came up from behind of Rebecca Harrow, 41 years old, who says she was punched in her face. And then the guy took off with her baby as she was left screaming for help and begging for help to the public and to the police. Her younger husband, Jake, who is 32 years old, was elsewhere during this alleged attack, so sheriffs would soon realize from very small but consistent discrepancies that their stories that day and leading up to it, the couple was just simply lying. The kidnapping never happened. And just days after crying wolf, they allowed this sickening display of condolences. A community came together, gathered around them, seeing them as victims, not as the villains that they really are. One woman, a stranger at the press conference, was seen on camera just consoling Rebecca. I mean, cradling her in her arms, putting her hands in her arms in her head and giving this woman prayers. And then fast forward a few hours later, because no Amber Alert was issued because of immediate discrepancies caught, the fast-moving detectives had enough evidence to arrest the couple, seen through the lies and the fake tears. Around this case is a web of documented tragedy within the bloodlines. You're going to find a convicted killer who says he's innocent of the murder of a 27-year-old woman, plus a 30-year-old man found dead in the Harrow couple's home, and then, of course, a long rap sheet. August 22nd in Cabazon, California, tactical vehicles rumbled past a low fence as deputies spread across a property where a baby swing sits on a porch. By mid-morning, the couple, Jake Mitchell Harrow and Rebecca Renee Harrow, are in custody, arrested, and within days, officially charged with murder and filing a false police report for the disappearance of their son, Emmanuel. The couple is being held on a $1 million bond. The sheriff's statement, it's stark. Investigators believe Emmanuel, he is dead. The search for him is now recovery of his body. Rewind a week earlier, the call came from Ukipia. Rebecca, his mom, reported she was attacked outside a sporting goods store while changing Emmanuel's diaper, saying she was just knocked out. And when she came to, her baby was gone. Deputies rolled up just before 8 p.m. and there was no suspect description, no vehicle, no credible lead to trigger an Amber Alert. Nothing captured on security video in the store's parking lot or surrounding streets. Rebecca has a bruised black eye, she said, was from the attacker who came up from behind. But frankly, to me, it actually looks like an old bruise. When you're hit and punched in the face in that moment, that kind of bruising that she had, it appears in stages, not instantly. She even went on camera, on television, telling this fictional tale, appearing as a victim, the heroic mom who sustained injury from this bad man who stole her baby, came up from behind and stole her baby. As detectives worked the case, the story began to buckle. Days later, the sheriff's department said the quiet part out loud, finally. This kidnapping, it did not happen. It didn't occur. Sunday, August 24th, just days later, a sun-blasted expanse of search in 90-plus degree heat near Gilman Springs Road off the 60 freeway. It's an area that locals call the Badlands. Choppers trace acres in this heat. Dozens of volunteers and officials looking for Emmanuel's body. Cadaver dogs sweep the brush. And the dad, Jake, is seen in a jail jumpsuit walking the field with detectives. News cameras rolling. The sheriff's team later cautions do not interpret his presence as assisting. By sunset, the line of searchers pull back. No remains are found. Normally, after reporting crimes for this long, I'd first think he was trying to cut a deal. He's talking and working out an exchange, the body's location for some kind of deal when it comes to sentencing. But nothing came of the search, and the sheriff alluded to Jake not fully cooperating. And legally speaking, once officers have probable cause and you are under arrest, they can transport you between custodial locations such as a jail, a crime scene, a hospital, without asking for your permission. But they also can't question him or say things like, show us where the body is. I wonder if they thought he'd feel the weight, the pressure, and just start talking. Now, I asked a prosecutor friend of mine what the legal perimeters were of this inmate field walk with Jake and why this would have even been allowed by his lawyer. He said the variables of taking a man in custody to a potential crime scene has variables such as, was he given his Miranda rights? Of course, we know he was. It's policing 101. Did he agree to it? We don't know. He could have agreed, but refused to talk. Was he arraigned prior? We know he was not. Does he have counsel? We don't know yet. But it seems as though Jake never uttered a word, and they found zero evidence in this field. But the DA did allude to the fact that they have an idea where the body is, they just haven't found it yet. When a baby disappears, investigators widen the scope of who are these people? What is their story? Any prior incidents, patterns, pressure points? And wow, did some hits come and surface from this family tree? You gotta buckle up for this one, it's just wild. In 2018, in a separate case involving Jake and his then ex-wife, not Rebecca, prosecutors say he shares a child with someone else, also an infant at the time of this incident, Carolina. She suffered catastrophic injuries, rib fractures, a fractured skull, brain hemorrhages, a seriously injured leg, and permanent disabilities, creating cerebral palsy from long-standing child abuse that this poor child has sustained till this day. She is bedridden till this day. She is forever disabled because of this monster father who had the audacity to go on in his life able to walk free while this girl can't, and then go on to have another child. Jake, he pleaded guilty to that case, guilty to the court. The DA of Riverside County said the prosecutor in that abuse case pleaded with the judge to give him prison. The judge instead imposed probation with a 6-year prison term stayed, a second chance, basically. The judge articulated on the record he wanted to give him a second chance. Probation instead of prison, against strong argument not to do that, to lock him up instead. The DA now calls that outcome outrageous, an error of judgment, arguing that had Jake been incarcerated then, Emmanuel would be alive today. The judge said to Jake at the time, "I'm giving you a second chance, don't mess it up," saying if he followed his probation rules, he would not get prison time, so he was free to go on with his life, given a second chance after prosecutors told the judge how severe the child abuse was to this young girl. And we now see how his second chance given by the courts ended up. This would have never happened if he was locked up for the first child abuse case. He certainly didn't learn his lesson or even fear the court system, because just 1 year later, after resolving the child abuse case, and in a separate filing from July of 2024, out of Banning, he was charged as a felon in possession of a firearm and ammunition. Records indicate he posted a $10,000 bail. So two very serious charges on his priors. This info informs how detectives assess risk when a child is missing, and his account is just not corroborated. With his past rap sheet alone, he'd be prime suspect number one, and he is. He's already seriously harmed a child, and he was a gun owner. And there's another name that appears on Jake's side of the family and police records, Hector Harrow, who is dead. Hector died at 30 years old. He's Jake's brother. There were a lot of rumors swirling online to clear it up. I spoke directly to the coroner's office for this exclusive confirmation. What happened to Jake's brother, Hector? I was told that Hector Harrow died in May of 2021 from an overdose. The coroner report stated accidental, with a combined drug toxicity of fentanyl, cocaine, and alcohol. Reportedly found in the couple, Rebecca and Jake's family home. Now, just the slightest dust of fentanyl can kill a person. It's really serious stuff, and I wonder if the cocaine was laced with fentanyl, because we're seeing that so often nowadays. Just another piece to the puzzle for detectives investigating baby Emmanuel's parents. In child death investigations, detectives, they map stressors in the family tree, addiction, violence, a health crisis, because patterns can illuminate what doesn't make sense when a baby disappears. Now let's look closer at the child's mom, Rebecca Harrow. To understand why this story feels so heavy, you have to roll the clock back even further, 8 years ago, to Palm Springs, California. March 15th of 2017, police find a 27-year-old woman named Jaylynn Amanda Keith in the bathtub of the apartment she shared with her boyfriend, James Bouchancin. James happens to be Rebecca Harrow's brother. Jaylynn has a single gunshot wound to the center of her forehead. A 9mm pistol lies under her body. At first, there's talk of suicide from James, but detectives, they don't buy it. They point to a separate head injury besides the gun entry wound and the gun's placement and bloodstain patterns that they say don't match a self-inflicted shot. Bouchancin is arrested after leaving California. He's extradited back for trial in 2018. A Riverside County jury convicts him of first-degree murder. Months later, in 2018, he's sentenced to 50 years to life. Prosecutors told jurors he rendered Jaylynn unconscious, placed her in the tub, held the shower curtain to control blood splatter, and fired a contact shot to her forehead, a scene staged to look like suicide. A staged suicide. But every homicide case has a counter-narrative, especially when there are family members who believe the system got it wrong. And in this one, that counter-narrative lands in this very long Facebook letter addressed to James, shared publicly and written, the author says, at the request of James' mother, who is also the mother to Rebecca. Before I read portions from it, two guardrails here. First, James was convicted by a jury and he is serving 50 to life. That verdict stands. Second, what follows are the author's claims and opinions, not established facts. Some of it ventures into retrospective mental health opinions about a deceased victim. I'm including some small portions because it reveals how contested this story remains inside the family, amongst friends and relatives, and how two people can read the same evidence in a very different way. The letter reads, "Dear James, I cannot imagine what it is like to be in prison unjustly. When I listened to Greg Johnson's closing argument, I knew you were in trouble. He arrogantly relied on the presumption of innocence, and that, given two equally likely explanations for circumstantial evidence, the defendant is entitled to the one that is most exculpatory. The author argues the defense missed chances, not pressing police about collected blood testing in the bathroom, not resolving this missing polo shirt, and not challenging the shower curtain demonstration that supported the prosecution's theory, the curtain perpendicular to the line of fire, shooter outside the tub, so it couldn't be self-inflicted. Saying, quote, crucially important was to have obtained the bloodstain expert's exculpatory written opinions. The blood evidence taken as a whole best supported a conclusion of a self-inflicted gunshot wound." In short, the letter basically claims the physical evidence, it fits both scenarios, murder and suicide data, in that the defense simply failed to give jurors a coherent suicide theory supported by expert testimony on risk and presentation. Now, the author, who notes a professional background in mental health, who knows if that's credible or not, she also suggests that Jay Lynn exhibited a high-functioning borderline personality disorder, citing intense in unstable relationships, and that alcohol in the relationship was the breaking point. And on the final day, she faced what the author of this letter calls a loss of hope, ending her own life. On the counter, friends and co-workers of Jay Lynn testified she was not someone who would take her own life, that she was very happy and bubbly, and the jury heard both sides and still returned first-degree murder verdict for Rebecca's brother, James. The letter even drafts the closing argument the author believes jurors should have heard, saying, either James killed the woman he loved, or Jay Lynn decided in one moment of despair to put a gun to her head and end her own life. The forensic evidence is equivocal. Each is consistent with a murder, and each is consistent with a suicide. And she ended with the hope that the Innocence Project would take a look at this case in the future. I've actually covered, as a crime correspondent, a few murder or suicide cases where both sides strongly believe the other, and it comes down to forensics, the backstory, the state of mind leading up to that day, and some can be really complex and in need of recreating the scenario, both scenarios, to get a good idea. In telling Emmanuel's story, wondering what led to his final moments, it helps to understand how a family arrives at this much tragedy, at this much violence in their lives, and what was their upbringing like, and how much of it affected the way that they look at the world, look at relationships, and look at love. And that equates back to the abuse that Emmanuel endured. Let me recap the players here in this family tree. Rebecca Harrow, Emmanuel's mother, is the sister of James, the man convicted in Jay Lynn's murder case. Jake Harrow, Emmanuel's father, is separate from the Palm Springs case. His record, though, includes the prior child cruelty conviction, which he ended up getting probation, and the 2024 possession of a firearm. But the background, with cops having no body right now, they all gathered information, and the couple's backstory is very telling and very important to build a case. I want to go now to the newly filed court documents by the DA's office. Rebecca and Jake, they are facing murder charges, also filing a false report, and also in the document is citing an evidence code, which makes it pretty much admissible to use Jake's prior criminal record as evidence for his upcoming murder trial. Now, the DA's office is just clearly putting it on the record, putting the court on notice that they will be using his record as evidence, painting a picture, the kind of person that he was, and the rap sheet that he had of domestic violence. If this ends up being a nobody conviction case, which right now it stands that it will be unless they find his remains, then this evidence code is critical to the DA, who needs his priors to come to a jury because it paints a picture of backstory, especially because Jake wasn't there at the time of this fake 911 kidnapping call, and it alludes to Jake being capable of killing a child and going into an elaborate cover-up with Rebecca. So why file now the charges so soon? In this case, filings often follow when investigators feel that they've locked down certain timelines, forensics, and statements enough to survive an arraignment and a bail review, and to plan right now for what seems to be a nobody conviction, which is rare. When I say it's rare, I mean it's not as common for the totality of murder trials that happen nationwide, because it can be a risk with a lot of weight on circumstantial evidence, but in this case, there are piles and mountains of evidence. Now let's circle back for a moment, because I wanted to take note about Rebecca's brother James' murder conviction of his girlfriend Jaylen. She is a victim that deserves to be center stage with a focus on her own story, what her life was like, what her dreams were, what was going on in her life, told by those closest to her, not reduced to basically a footnote in someone else's file. Friends of hers described Jaylen as vibrant and stubborn in all the best ways, the kind of person who kept smiling through the storms. The day before she died, she voiced fears about where things were headed in her life and in her relationship. So the next morning, she was found dead with a single devastating bullet wound in the forehead in a bathtub. She was so young and vibrant that you can actually see her personality in her photos. I'd really love to find out more on how Rebecca Harrow and her brother James were raised, what their childhoods were like to end up both siblings, take that in, both siblings, James and Rebecca, now facing life in prison, one already convicted and one on her way to a conviction. I can't even imagine what the family of James and Rebecca must be thinking right now, the odds of both siblings years apart to end up facing separate murder trials. We do not know where Emmanuel is or how he died or the full scope of evidence investigators have beyond public statements in court calendars. We know that he was sustaining such abuse over a short life that he ultimately died of his injuries. But we know unless someone brokers a deal, murder trials are up next. Where the case goes from here, if this proceeds as a nobody homicide, expect to see a lot of digital forensics, phone location data, app activities, messaging, cloud records, vehicle telematics, forensic biology, any blood or trace evidence tested and compared to known profiles, timeline testing, every statement weighed against cameras, pings, purchases, in all movements, motion practice, the DA seeking to admit prior acts, the defense seeking to exclude those prior acts. Search operations, if officials truly have a strong indication of where Emmanuel is, as they say, it's all the resources and money that is going into looking for him and finding him. There's always a risk in stories like this, turning a baby into a case number. Emmanuel is not a case number. He's a little boy who should be lunging for a sippy cup, gnawing on his little toys, startling himself with his own laugh. And of course, when I say recovery, when I say presumed dead, those are all terms that fail to carry the weight. At the center of this is a child who really deserved to be loved instead of spending his short life abused day after day until he succumbed to his own injuries. I'm Melissa. This is Killer Jeans. Thank you for tuning in. We'll continue to follow this story to see where it leads for retribution for 7-month-old Emmanuel.